If your toe wasn't tapping, you better look at your smartwatch and see if you're still alive out there this evening. Thank you so much, Alice. Well, we have come together over these days, and as Greg said, thank you for coming back on Monday night of all nights to be part of our time together. We are looking at a whole different stream of Scripture, perhaps, than you've ever looked at before. Noticing things that maybe you've never noticed before. I'll tell you honestly, until about 10 years ago, I hadn't noticed any of this. But as I started looking around in our world and realized just how out of touch we sometimes are as the church with what God is doing in the world, that maybe we needed to pay attention a bit more and bring what was happening out there to the text to see what the text had to say. And there we discovered that in the beginning God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and human beings didn't get around to doing that right away, and we experienced the flood, and God said to Noah, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and we didn't do it, and we hung together. So finally God said, don't make me come down there, and God came down, and God dispersed us to the ends of the earth, into our various cultures and peoples, because of, I think, the conviction that God knew that the only way we could know God fully as God could be known, would be to come back together with our various perspectives and various understandings. I've spent most of my career kind of on the boundaries of places and spaces that were often very unfamiliar to me. And that, of course, started in childhood. My parents, Ms. Hires, brought a picture of my mother from 1964 tonight, before we went to the Philippines, when my parents went to Tignal to talk about the work they were going to do starting in 1964. I told you last night, you're my people, right? When somebody brings a 60-year-old picture of your mother to church, one evening when you're speaking, you know that you're my people. I've become, I guess you would say, a kind of Sherpa, a guide. You know, when you go to the Himalayas, the Sherpas start taking you up the mountain. And I guess I sort of fancy myself as a Sherpa to particularly help students towards spaces and places that they've never been to before. So I've traveled the world with students over 30 or 40 years. But you don't have to go way over there to find otherness and difference in the world. And so I've also done a lot of site visits for my classes here in the Georgia area. And one of the places I love to take students is the Sri Venkateshwara Hindu Temple in Riverdale, Georgia. Right across from Riverdale High School, where Archie and Jughead and Betty and Veronica went to high school. They've got a Sri Venkateshwara temple over there, one of the Hindu deities. It's a great place to visit if you ever get the opportunity. Just present yourself and they deal with you when you come. I told my students we were going to go to the temple, and one of my older students, Gary, came to me and said, I don't need to go to no Hindu temple. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, I went to a bunch of those Hindu temples over in Vietnam. He was a vet. And I said, Gary, you're only proving to me you need to go because they have Buddhist temples in Vietnam, not Hindu temples. So let's make the trip. So he shows up and we get in the van. It's all guys. We drive up to the Sri Venkateshwara, or down actually from Rome to the Sri Venkateshwara Temple in Riverdale. We get out, we go in, we see all of the images of the deities in there, and the main altar, the main place for the image of Lord Venkateshwara is in the very center part. As we moved in, I made a donation to the temple so that the priest would bring us in and would show us what they do as they make puja daily in the Hindu tradition. We received, as a result, the gift of an apple. A candle was moved around our bodies to bring a blessing. And then we turned to walk out, and Gary couldn't even wait to get out of that little sanctuary where the main god was before he said, "Dr. Nash, did we just worship an idol?" And I said, "I didn't. Did you?" "Oh, Lord, no, I didn't." "Well, good. You're fine. I'm fine. We're all fine." We walked out. He was still angry. We got out to the outside of the temple where the little shrine to Hanuman, the monkey god, guards the entrance to the temple. And Gary promptly walked over to the gate, and he took his apple and he threw it through the gate toward Hanuman, the monkey god. And he said, "That monkey can come over there and eat that apple. He can have it." We went on back down to the van and we got in. And as we were pulling out, I couldn't help it. Again, it was all guys. I said, "Gentlemen, as long as I've been bringing students to the Sri Venkateshwara Temple, Gary here is the first one who ever left a gift for one of the idols." Now, what I didn't know is that I would exhaust the next 3 days trying to talk Gary off the ledge because he thought he had sacrificed to a false god. So I've done that. I've sat in worship services in so many different languages that I've lost count. Worship services with words and music that I couldn't understand, but that I just had to kind of feel my way through. I've deciphered directions that people gave to me in languages I couldn't speak, and yet somehow I've managed to find my way to where I needed to be. One time I found myself in Gare du Nord, the train station in Paris, and I promise you, for whatever reason, I couldn't get out. I couldn't get out. I couldn't figure out which way the exit was. And I was just going around in circles trying to get out of the train station. When suddenly I felt a little tug. And I turned around, and there was a young woman in a kind of burqa. And she looked at me and she pointed and she said, "Sortie, sortie, exit." And she walked me over so that I could get out of Gare du Nord. Sometimes they bless you, you know. Crossing boundaries is hard work. It demands much of us. It is frustrating and tedious and challenging, and yet it is exactly what Jesus calls us to do. Jesus calls us to places beyond our own space. Jesus calls us into neighborhoods in our own cities to which we don't want to go. Jesus calls us to love people we would really rather not love. Democrats, Republicans, people of a different skin hue, people who don't love us in return. Why does Jesus do it? Well, first, Jesus does call us to these places because it is good for those whom we meet there. We're possessed by God's love, or at least we ought to be, and that love compels us to care for those who are different from us. And we can't care for them by simply staying in our own space. We have to cross the street. We have to get into the boat. We have to climb on the plane. And we have to move to their place. Jesus is pretty clear about it. Take this passage I just read in Mark's gospel. Jesus has been pretty clear that his primary purpose is to call the Jewish people back to the work that God intended for them. And he's there to remind them that they're to be a blessing to the families of the earth. And he's called to remind them that their election is about that calling, and they seem to have forgotten it. He's got this band of 12 guys, and he decides to send them across the Sea of Galilee and into the hearts and lives of people who are radically different from them. Now, this is what I call this Bible geography. Mark's gospel is all about Bible geography. Whenever you're reading Mark and you hear the words Judea or Jerusalem, then you boo. Boo! Hiss! And if you hear the word Galilee, then start clapping, because Mark is all about the Galilee and he can't stand Jerusalem and the Judeans. So Jesus in Mark's gospel is moving back and forth across the Sea of Galilee between the Jewish side of the sea and the Gentile side of the sea. He is launching the disciples out into places that are radically different from theirs. And so what happens in Mark's gospel is when you're reading about the Jewish side, then there's some guy in the temple who's possessed by a demon, and Jesus says, "Demon, get out," and the demon gets out. And it's all very clean and it's all very neat. But when you're on the Gentile side, oh, that is nasty. There the demon-possessed guy is out in the cemetery, dirty, filthy. And Jesus sends the demons out. And what do they do? They go into the pigs. You think they're pigs on the Jewish side of the Gentile Sea, or of the Sea of Galilee? No. The pigs are on the Gentile side. And it's very interesting because the storms in Mark's gospel never happen when the disciples are going from the Gentile side of the sea to the Jewish side of the sea. The storms happen when they're going from the Jewish side of the sea to the Gentile side of the sea. That's when they're moving away from their place and toward the other place. From the familiar to the unfamiliar. And so the waves crash over the side of the boat, and the disciples have to strain at the oars, and progress in the water is almost impossible, and the disciples are frightened. And it's for that reason that I think the storms in Mark's gospel are generated as much from the challenge of crossing cultural boundaries as they are from crossing weather patterns. Things become stormy. We face challenges we'd rather not face. The light switches don't work like they work at home. You have to take the hotel key and you got to put it in the little slot before the lights come on, and we go back down to the desk to tell them the lights don't work, and on it goes. Jesus expects us to put up with the challenges of moving away from safe space because Jesus has called us to bless the lives of others. But there's another reason Jesus calls us into the boat and across the water. Jesus does it because Jesus knows it is good for us. We're not fully human. We are not fully human until we have received the blessings that God intends for us to receive from others. We need their blessing as much as they need ours. Israel had trouble getting it right. We have trouble getting it right. And we sort of sit back and we say as the church, well, you know, those Jewish folk, they didn't quite get it right. And so God had to choose the church because we do it right. I was sitting in a hotel in Ecuador. I guess I can tell this story. I don't want to step on any toes. I can step on my own. Apparently, a mission team from the U.S. had arrived the previous night to take Ecuador by storm. They were having breakfast around the table. I was sitting with an Ecuadorian friend. The waiter came around to see if any of them would like some orange juice, and one by one, they turned down the orange juice, and one of them from the head of the table said, y'all remember, we're not supposed to drink the orange juice in these countries because it's made with dirty water. And every Ecuadorian head in the place turned to listen. The woman leading the group came down a little later, and the waiter came with the orange juice and said, would you like some orange juice? And she said, yeah, I'd love some. And everybody thundered, I thought you weren't supposed to drink the orange juice in these countries. And I thought we were going to get a little sense. And she said, oh, you can drink the orange juice in a nice hotel like this. It's when we go out into the jungle out there that you can't drink the orange juice. It's always hard to live in the tension between being a blessing and being blessed. To live there, we have to give up on a perspective that says that we are better than the other families of the earth, that God has chosen them over us. You see, there's something we overlook in this passage. Something very interesting. Jesus tells his disciples to get into the boat and cross the sea, and then he goes up on the mountain to pray. And I don't know how he sees them, but somehow from up on the mountain, he knew they were struggling at the oars and against the wind. He made his way out onto the water, and he began to walk. And Mark tells us that he intended to pass them by. Jesus didn't give a rip about the disciples in the boat. And I think it made him mad. I think, where was Jesus going? He was going to the other side. And the disciples, scared to death, forced him to turn around and come back and get in the boat with them so that the waves would stop crashing over the boat. And Jesus did it. Jesus' intent is to be with the Gentile folk on the other side of the lake when the disciples arrive. Jesus was going to be not too far from here, but he was not going to be here. This is where the great ordination text comes in, because in my boat, you ministers and you deacons who are ordained to service and ministry among this people, you're the ones Jesus puts in the boat. You're the ones who are here to say, wait, just calm down. Jesus is over there, not too far from here. Just hang on. He'll be there when we get there. That's the intention. That's what Jesus wants. It's to the Gentiles he's going. He expects his disciples will make it in one piece across the lake, and that he'll be standing with the Gentiles on the other side when they arrive. The disciples are even afraid of Jesus. They aren't sure who this strange being is who's coming to them across the water. The Jesus they're familiar with is the Jesus on the Jewish side. But this strange Jesus who crosses boundaries and engages otherness and difference, him they don't know. So they cry out, and they don't cry out to Jesus. They cry out because they're scared to death that they're seeing a ghost. There's one final word toward the end of the story. We find it in verse 54. It says, when they had come out of the boat on the Gentile side, the Gentiles recognized him. They knew him. Jesus had been there before. Jesus' presence was as much felt there as it was back on the Jewish side. It's a good lesson for us. Jesus has high expectations. We've spent considerable time on our own shore. We've received encouragement and support and love from Jesus on our own side of the lake. But this isn't enough. Jesus is also working among the other families of the earth and calling us from beyond our own place and toward them. And he's blessed them, and he's calling them from their own place toward us. You know what the nation with more Christians in it in the world than any other nation is about to be? The People's Republic of China. And did you know that the gathering of Filipino Baptists and Chinese Baptists and Korean Baptists in this country will be larger than the gatherings of either the Southern Baptist Convention or the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship? So kind of put that in your pipe and smoke it. Those of you who are old, old Southern Baptists may remember a little program we had in 1976 called Bold Mission Thrust. We were going to share the gospel with the whole world by the year 2000, and we didn't need anybody's help. And I think somebody misheard, because I think what God said was, I'm going to share every nation of the earth with you by the year 2000 and see what you do with it. God has blessed them and us, and now he calls us toward each other in some pretty powerful ways. One of my most recent experiences at Mercer has been to lead a Mercer on Mission experience in Morocco. And this is how it was put together. And I want to end with this story. We got a group of American Christian students and a group of Moroccan Muslim students, and we brought them together at a university in Morocco for the purpose of reading each other's sacred texts and seeing what we could learn from each other. We read the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible, and we read it in the Quran. We went on hikes together where we talked about what it was like being children and growing up in our
traditions. One day, one Sunday morning, we found ourselves in a Christian church in Fez. We were worshiping. And as we worshiped and the music was being sung, either in French or in Arabic, I suddenly noticed something. The Muslim students began to translate the music and the scripture and the sermon so that the Christian students could understand what people of their own faith were saying to them. And I looked at the students, that our students, at least one of them sitting beside me, and I said, where else in the world right now are Muslim believers in Allah translating a Christian worship service so that Christian students can worship God? Somebody once came up to me after I did a presentation on other religions and said, you seem to think that the God of Islam and the God of Christianity are the same God. And I said, how many gods are there? And he said, well, there's only one God. Okay. Yeah, but you're implying that they're worshiping the same God. How many gods are there? We're all fellow strugglers. We're all just trying to understand the world in which we live. We're trying to love the people we're called to love. We're trying to worship God as best we can, and we might get it right and we might get it wrong, but the reality is we're seeking to do it. And at the very least, instead of tossing the apple through the gate at the monkey god, we ought to thank the priest for the blessing through Christ. Amen.